On Radio 4, Plants from Roots to Riches, in which Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, continues her major history of plant science.
The effortless movement of plants and seeds around the world during the late 19th century, such a proudly celebrated achievement by the Victorians, was having an unwanted side effect. Invasives, plant immigrants. With no natural predators to control them on new soil, one man's flower was turning into another man's weed.
Some of the most aggressive invasives can be introduced to a very small area and then explode, out competing for nutrients or for light, crowding out things, and so can lead to species decline and species extinction.
If an introduced plant becomes disruptive to the native flora in its new location, then this is when it's known as an invasive. Some of our most notorious invasives have become only too familiar. Japanese knotweed is a well-known pain for most gardeners in the UK and has no natural predators. Giant hogweed is another one, a huge triffid-like monster from the Caucasus Mountains. The term invasive plant has rightly come to have some very dark connotations. The naturalist Charles Darwin was one of the first to discuss invasives. At many of his island stops on board the Beagle, he noticed and lamented that in some cases, invaders had replaced previously dominant native plants. Historian Jim Endersby has been looking at Darwin's diaries on this matter.
When he arrives in St Helena, he points out that deforestation is already quite extensive and that alien species can hardly have failed to destroy some of the native kinds. So this is already something he's very conscious of quite early on in the voyage. And it's with these ideas in mind, I think, that he reaches the Galapagos and begins to notice how intense the struggle for existence is in an island.
St Helena, situated so remote from any continent in the midst of a great ocean and possessing a unique flora, was a little world within itself which excites our curiosity.
But the island, he felt, was now in a sterile condition with limited flora, compared with what it must once have held.
I believe that there is not any account extant of the vegetation when the island was covered with trees. It is not improbable that even in the present day, similar changes may be in progress.
But why did some species flourish in a foreign habitat and not others? Joseph Hooker, as explorer and botanist, became very interested in this question, not least because he was one of the people responsible for unwittingly introducing one of our most notorious invasives, one with gorgeous flowers and an insatiable thirst for land, probably currently marauding through a landscape near you.
Hooker's own rhododendrons from the Himalaya, which are published at his father's instigation in a beautiful illustrated book, create something of a rhododendron craze in Britain in the 1840s and 50s. They become very popular garden plants. And we now have large parts of England overrun with rhododendrons that have escaped from people's gardens and have grown into impenetrable thickets and have choked out native vegetation in many parts of the country. So it's something of an irony that Hooker, who was one of the first botanists to really think about the impact of invasives, should himself have been at least slightly responsible for a major invasion of Britain.
Many of today's worst weeds started out as deliberate introductions. The very things that made them such spectacular trophy plants in gardens, their huge size, exotic flowers and vast leaves, also appears to have made them the perfect invaders. It's an uncomfortable irony that plant hunters, botanic gardens and nurseries played a major role in introducing some pretty troublesome plants. And once the invasive is out of its box, there's no putting it back. One of the top 10 invaders globally is Lantana. We know it in Britain as a beautiful ornamental pot plant and shrub. It's a native of South America and was brought to Europe by Dutch explorers and cultivated across the world for its colourful flowers. It was introduced into Kolkata as a flowering hedge to beautify the Indian countryside around the 1800s. Now it's widespread in India, South Africa and Australia and is a real problem plant. Because in the right climate, it grows in dense thickets the size of a small tree, blocking out light to any other plants around and preventing cattle from grazing. As plant ecologist Shonal Bhagwat of the Open University explains, its edible appeal is part of its weapon.
It produces very delicious, tasty berries. As a child, I used to go and collect those berries and get my hands red and black with the color of those berries.
Did you eat the berries?
Yeah, they are delicious, actually. They you can make marmalade or jam out of them.
Out of lantana.
And I mean, it's no surprise why birds like bulbuls in India feed on the berries. But that also means that these birds disperse berries and the seeds of lantana well beyond where they feed on them. And that's what happened with the first introductions from botanical gardens. Soon it was everywhere.
Once again, the botanic garden is the villain of the piece. Indian foresters realised as early as 1870 that with such effective seed dispersal and lack of any natural predator to halt its progress, lantana was sweeping all before it. Indian forest reports across the southern half of the country bear witness to its rapid spread over the next few decades.
Dietrich Brandis, a German-trained forest officer who worked in the British forestry and spent a large part of his career in India, said that lantana has spread with extraordinary vigour in Ceylon and the peninsula of India, considered by some to be the cause of the spike disease of sandalwood in Coorg. So this was in 1906, when sandalwood was a highly traded, economically important commodity for the empire.
So it was already starting to impact the true products of the forest at that point.
Absolutely. And then half a century later, in 1950s, in post-independence India, narrative again shifts to something else. So a forest officer called Jayadev in the Nilgiri Forest Division mentions about lantana. He says it has taken possession of the ground in dense, impenetrable thickets in young teak plantations. Management will also include uprootal of lantana over the entire plantation area. So an incredible effort was spent in really just pulling this plant out from the forest where it had invaded. Despite everything that has been thrown at this plant, nothing has actually worked, and this plant is still spreading everywhere.
Oceanic islands are even more vulnerable to invasion by non-native plants. Many are full of endemic species and classified as biodiversity hotspots. Kew conservation biologist Colin Club specialises in monitoring plant communities on islands and the impact of new arrivals.
One of the unique plants on Ascension is the Ascension Island parsley fern, Anagramma ascensionis. And this was first discovered and described by Joseph Hooker when he visited the island in 1843. And I've got in front of me here Hooker's original herbarium specimen of a number of examples that he collected there. The culprit for the parsley fern's demise is a species of maidenhair fern. People will be familiar with that. So common pot plant, Adiantum, and this particular species is Adiantum capillus veneris. What's interesting is that Hooker never mentioned this particular species, and it would have been known to him. It's quite a well-known species of fern. So we think that sometime it was introduced, and it was probably one of those vicarious things. It came in as a spore attached to something else, and it obviously got to Ascension and liked the conditions there. And it's a bit of a thug. It's very tolerant of varying moisture conditions. So you find it in the dry, exposed volcanic cinders, but then also in these wet seeps, which is the habitat for the parsley fern up on Green Mountain. And what we're observing there is that the maidenhair fern is really aggressively filling all those niches.
The annual surveys declared the parsley fern extinct in 2003. Then, in 2009, it reappeared.
We surveyed around and actually did find four individuals finally on this very precipitous cliff up in Green Mountain. Very, very exciting. So we collected a couple of fronds into sterile petri dishes, and then we got that back here into micropropagation. And our colleagues in the Conservation Biotechnology Unit here at Kew have managed to then grow that and taken it right through to adult plants. And that, and in fact I've got in front of me here a specimen from that ex situ cultivation down in microprop, which we can compare with Hooker's specimen. And satisfy ourselves that this is indeed, we're dealing with the same plant. And in fact, we can produce now the parsley fern in micropropagation in large numbers. But there's no point of reintroducing a species back in the wild unless you've actually sorted out the very situation that caused the demise of that species. In this case, it's these invasive ferns. So one of the things we're doing now experimentally is beginning to do some clearance, small-scale clearance of this fern to try and develop a suitable habitat for the parsley fern as a self-sustaining population in the wild. I think we're going to have these conservation interventions all the time, so actually using horticultural skills in the field to try and maintain the balance, and active intervention if we see that the invasives are overwhelming the situation.
But despite their huge potential for harm, it's usually only a minority of invaders that actually cause substantial damage. Trying to eradicate or manage them can be very expensive and may not be cost-effective compared to the value of the crop or other natural product you may be trying to save. So is trying to control them ultimately futile? Instead of some Canute-like attempt to hold back the tide and pretend we can restore ecosystems to some long-vanished natural state, should we try to understand and exploit these brave new worlds of introduced species, putting them to use in flood control, food or timber production?
Small local interventions have started to try and make something out of lantana. Since it's an abundant resource, why not we make baskets out of this plant, or why not we make paper out of this plant? And that provides livelihoods to people who otherwise live in poverty in Indian countryside. But it also addresses the problem of keeping an invasive species under control. And of concern for conservationists is how can we keep more important endemic or endangered species in these ecosystems. And so keeping lantana under control and cutting it back for making basketry, etc., can find the so-called win-win solution.
So we might be seeing a lot more lantana marmalade in the supermarket.
Possibly.
So whether we like it or not, alien species have and will always have a place in our landscape. Understanding this is vital. It will help resolve some, though not all, of the problems which invasive plants cause. And looking at what's happened on Ascension Island may provide insights into our attitudes and approaches.
It's actually a kind of artificial cloud forest there now. So a novel ecosystem and a combination of non-native and native, invasive and naturalised species. And certainly now, with potential and suggested impacts of climate change and looking at resilience of combinations of plants in particular habitats, it may be that we have to think of non-natives in a slightly different context and not just as the enemies, particularly in habitat restoration and species reintroduction, but also recognising the role and the function that some of these non-native plants can offer.
The struggle faced by Kew and the island's conservationists to bring the parsley fern back from the brink of extinction shows just how difficult it is to strike a balance between natives and incomers. New plant species are still being identified at a rate of 2,000 per year, so as yet unknown botanical troublemakers may be poised for invasion. In fact, we've yet to resolve the mystery of what makes plants succeed in particular locations, a point which Charles Darwin was pondering back in 1844.
Many plants seem made to live everywhere, and others nowhere but where they seem to have been generated.
Darwin's friend Joseph Hooker wondered if it would ever be possible to predict potential culprits. It's a question scientists are addressing today, thanks to the science that at the start of the 20th century was to transform botany. Genetics.
The presenter was Professor Cathy Willis. The reader was Ian Redford, and the series is produced by Adrian Washburn.